The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Money FM 89.3, best of prime time.
You're listening to Prime Time on Money FM 89.3. I'm Rachel Kelly. Now, the Monetary Authority of Singapore kept its monetary policy stance unchanged in its latest review, and this was largely in line with most analyst expectations. But the question is now, could we see tightening at the next review in October? Well, to give us an update on what's been happening and some analysis on this latest policy review, we're joined today by Michelle Jamrisco, Senior Asia Economy Reporter at Bloomberg. Michelle, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Always wonderful to have you with us to break down the latest economic news coming out of the region, Michelle. And let's start off with this announcement from the MAS. It did keep its policy stance unchanged. And, you know, this was widely expected. So I've got to ask you, were there any surprises in the latest release?
Well, there were a couple of treats in here for MAS watchers, Rachel. As you mentioned, nothing in the policy stance. All of the analysts in the Bloomberg survey had predicted no change to the policy band settings, and that's what we got. But another thing we were looking for was what sort of hints the central bankers would give on the outlook for the rest of the year. And on that front, investors were especially looking for a change to language that the MAS had in their previous statement about accommodative policy being appropriate for, quote, some time. And they did remove the some time phrase from this latest statement. So that might seem trivial to outside watchers, but that really opens the door for some potential tightening in their next decision in October. And secondly, what I thought interesting, especially as an economy reporter, was how they dealt with the growth outlook in this report. So normally when the Ministry for Trade and Industry releases the GDP report at the same time as the MAS, they'll include a forecast range for Singapore's 2021 GDP. And MTI left that out of their report. And instead of offering a revised range in their statement, the MAS only said that they see growth exceeding the 4 to 6% range that the government had previously estimated. So we didn't get quite a concrete target there. And there's sort of an uncharacteristic vagueness around where they see growth landing in 2021. Certainly reflecting all the moving parts right now, especially on vaccination and virus patterns globally. But we do know it's a bit of a more upbeat tone for the city-state.
So with that upbeat tone, what are Bloomberg economists forecasting for the economy going forward?
Well, before the GDP and MAS reports were released last week, our analysts surveyed by Bloomberg already were on the high end of the government's forecast range. So the median estimate was about 6% before these decisions came through. And in those quarter one figures that we got the same day, we saw another strong gain in manufacturing, smaller contractions in construction and services than in the fourth quarter. So overall, small year-on-year expansion, whereas we had expected maybe a modest shrinking. So after these reports, analysts are going even higher on Singapore growth for this year. And of the ones that we updated Friday, Standard Chartered is now at 6.3%. Barclays is at 7.5%, and Bank of America is at 8%. So we are seeing some higher numbers than even the upper end of that previous range and kind of more in line with what the MAS said about being on the high end there.
And what are some of the key drivers for economic growth that these economists are looking at for the Singapore economy?
Yeah, well, I think we can expect manufacturing to continue to be strong. That's been a region-wide story, especially on the electronics front, semiconductors, that sort of area. But goods trade overall has been quite strong throughout the pandemic globally. So that's certainly something that's going to benefit Singapore's trade-reliant economy. But even in construction, I think we're going to see a bit of a turnaround. They did flag that the first quarter wasn't it was still in contraction year on year. But, you know, as more workers are coming back to work sites and we hear more hammering in the background, in fact, you know, outside my own apartment, usually you're hearing a lot, it'll be more of an indication of that sector coming back. And certainly services it's a big question mark, considering especially the tourism sector still struggling and leisure and hospitality. But, you know, we're seeing, especially here in Singapore, a lot more people being comfortable going out to restaurants, soliciting businesses that they hadn't before. So that'll be maybe a slow grind, but certainly some improvement on the horizon.
And just going back to the monetary policy stance, Michelle, you did mention that some time language has changed, the nuancing of that language has changed. I've seen some reports that have quoted analysts saying that there's a 30% probability that MAS will tighten policy to a slightly appreciation bias at its October review. Others have said that this language signals that that's definitely on the horizon. So are we likely to see change in policy stance come October?
Right. It certainly seems to be anyone's guess right now, right? It's dangerous to forecast that many months ahead. But most analysts seem to be leaning still toward no, that the MAS will stick to its policy stance again in that second of twice yearly decisions. But the MAS definitely opened the door for tightening if they need to. And if things heat up faster than they expected and some of these uncertainties around vaccination, the virus spread fade, then there's a non-trivial chance that they tighten in October. And as you mentioned, you know, some analysts are at 30, maybe 40%. So getting close to that, like, you know, half and half decision time. But even before the decision last week, analysts were pointing to the building risk of the tightening, but also always caveating with, you know, the fact that there's so many uncertainties right now. This is such a long way off, and we'll especially be watching inflation figures and all those virus factors in the months ahead.
So what does all of this mean for investors, and I guess also for the Singapore dollar?
Well, with Singapore's reliance on trade, and especially its trade ties to U.S. and China, there are certainly upsides and reasons to remain upbeat about the recovery here. And domestically, vaccinations seem to be picking up. Virus cases have stayed low. So we'll expect to see more healing in construction and services industries, though not fully healed just yet, of course. On the Singapore dollar, our markets team has been tracking the modest boost the currency got after the MAS and GDP reports. Going forward, the consensus is not to expect too much excitement in the currency swings, given that core inflation might pick up, but is still historically low, as the MAS points out. Again, though, this all comes with the caveat of it's still very uncertain global backdrop, a lot of factors that are factoring into to where the Singapore economy will go, and certainly that Sing dollar.
We're speaking with Michelle Jamrisco, Senior Asia Economy Reporter at Bloomberg. And Michelle, while things are looking up for Singapore's economy, let's shift away from Singapore for a moment, because there was a really interesting article that was published that you worked on for Bloomberg, and you highlighted that an estimated 150 million people slipped down the economic ladder in 2020, and that's the first pullback in almost three decades. So this growing middle class has been a key pillar of global economic growth. So maybe you can tell us, where do these figures come from, and what does this mean for the global economic outlook?
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, for decades, we'd seen this growing middle class globally, many lower income countries especially finding greater consumer spending, more formalized employment, enriching global trade, all while global poverty was in retreat. And that all changed last year. And as you mentioned, an estimated 150 million fell down that economic ladder. Mm-hmm. That happened at the same time, by the way, that the World Bank calculated the first significant increase in global poverty, also since the 1990s. So that 150 million figure was calculated by the Pew Research Center in the U.S., and it's always tough to cast a standard across countries around socioeconomic class for several reasons, including cost of living and currency swings. But Pew's math works out by first separating the global middle class, those earning $10 to $50 a day in income, from the poor, who they define as earning less than $2 a day, and then the low income at $2 to $10 a day. So those bottom two categories, the poor and low income, had 152 million in new entrants last year amid the global recession. And as far as what that means for the global economic outlook, there are two primary conclusions here. It's a huge hole to dig out of. And two, this U.S. and China-driven global rebound this year masks what's set to be a very uneven recovery. So not all countries and not all classes will reap the same benefits. And this is something that the likes of the IMF and the World Bank have been warning about almost since the start of the pandemic.
Yeah. And Michelle, there was a statistic, I think earlier this month, the International Monetary Fund predicted that the global economy in 2024 will be 3% smaller than it would have been without the pandemic. So taking a look across the globe, and you mentioned, you know, we're talking about this uneven recovery, rather, which economies have been worst impacted here?
Yeah, that's right. Well, sluggish vaccination and low supply of doses is a big issue for the lower income countries. So a lot of the developing economies haven't and probably won't be healing as fast as some of the big ticket economies like the U.S. and China. And so in that same report that you mentioned, the IMF was more upbeat about the immediate outlook, and they upgraded the global forecast for this year to 6% from 5.5%, coming after a 3.3% contraction last year. Yeah. But underneath all that is, of course, a longer run missed opportunities that you point out, and also, again, that uneven recovery. So it's a stark contrast with what we saw happen after the global financial crisis, when rich nations were actually hit harder. Whereas this time, the IMF sees low-income countries and emerging markets suffering more. And one figure they put on it, they estimated per capita income losses over the 2020 to 2022 period in emerging and developing markets, excluding China, at around 20% of their per capita GDP pre-COVID in 2019. And that's way worse than the 11% that they see in advanced economies. So really all around, they're kind of warning, you know, we need to get nobody safe until all are safe is the message. And the vaccine progress is really going to impact how these developing economies progress.
And what does this mean for industry, Michelle? Because one of the interesting things about the article that you worked on was that it provided some really fascinating profiles from across the region. There was one particular profile from India who'd been saving up for a car for his family, but is now unable to because of the impact of COVID-19. And we've seen a lot of international automotive players investing in India, and India has, of course, been hit by another wave of COVID-19. You also speak about inflation hitting the meat industry in Brazil. And then over in Thailand, you speak to some street vendors and how they've had to shift and realign and reassess their priorities in life, whether it's owning a house, owning a car, or renting. So what kind of long-term impact are we likely to see COVID-19 and the impact that it's had on industry, on the global economy in the longer term?
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, you bring up a lot of really key points and trends that are being debated right now. It's interesting what's been going on in global trade. I mean, I mentioned earlier that the goods trade has been, surprisingly positive throughout the pandemic, even though the initial fear was that the global recession would mean economies all over the world would turn inward and source so much of their goods at home. And we are seeing a bit of that vaccine nationalism and that dose hoarding that's becoming more prevalent, unfortunately, in a lot of economies. But the broader goods trade has been booming through much of the pandemic. And one of the consistent big winners has been electronics and, of course, semiconductors, with a very tight market from Taiwan and South Korea suppliers. But the other big trend that you hint at is on the prices side. We have a great inflation debate raging and a few things going on here. Energy and food prices, which are typically more volatile than other goods and have a disproportionately higher impact in developing economies than in advanced ones, those have been surging in part due to geopolitical issues with oil, but also some idiosyncratic issues like pig diseases in China that are driving up pork prices and a key commodity there. And the second quarter price data, by the way, will look very high, but primarily due to such a low base from the disastrous second quarter we had last year. So it'll be a while for us to get clean inflation data worldwide again. But in the meantime, it's rocky for industry right now. I mean, we are seeing pockets of great demand, but also imbalances around supply and demand. So, seeing jumps in some prices and retreats in others, still low levels in others. So the other thing to watch that I would point out is, with all the stimulus that governments have pumped into their economies, especially that latest $2 trillion package from the U.S., this will surely result in higher prices at some point. And it's just a matter of how long that will take, how long it will last, and whether it will force any central bankers to move. But with all these infrastructure and green energy plans, not just in the U.S. but elsewhere, prices for materials like copper and lumber are on the rise and expected to stay fairly high. And this all means a rocky year for industry, and it might be a while for those supply and demand imbalances to kind of come back into a calm reading so that prices aren't swinging wildly.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much as always for taking the time to speak with us. That was really interesting. We've been speaking with Michelle Jamrisco, Senior Asia Economy Reporter at Bloomberg, right here on Money FM 89.3.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.